You're listening to Global Heart to Heart Radio. This is Mary Alice, and today we welcome a very fascinating guest, Mac Hulbert, Senior Imagician at Art Authority. The mission of Art Authority is to partner with internationally renowned art authorities, museums, and artists in order to make the world's art accessible, helping bring all the world's art to all the world. ArtAuthority.net and 1000museums.com. Mac is a prolific lecturer, and he conducts workshops on digital output, digital imaging, and fine art printing. Mac is also a photographer, also the co-founder of Nash Editions, the world's first professional fine art digital printmaking studio. Nash Editions was co-founded in 1990 by rock musician and photographer Graham Nash and Mac Hulbert. Mac is also the recipient of numerous awards, including but not limited to the 2007 Lifetime Achievement Award from Digital Imaging Marketing Association and the 2000 Computer World Smithsonian Medal for his pioneering work in digital printmaking. Mac Hulbert also founded the Image Collective in 2010 to provide multiple services for cultural heritage organizations. The Image Collective exists to serve, preserve, and celebrate the world's images through its research and education. And Mac has long been active in the environmental movement, helping to produce benefits for the Cousteau Society, Greenpeace, and many others. Before Art Authority and Nash Editions, Mac Hulbert was a tour manager for Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Carole King, and Peter, Paul, and Mary. Now please join me on Global Heart to Heart Radio for a very interesting conversation with Mac Hulbert. Good morning and welcome, Mac Hulbert.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for being here today. I greatly appreciate you taking the time. The first thing I have is about Art Authority. And I love on your website, helping to bring all the world's art to all the world. I love that.
Well, that's what we're trying to do.
Right.
It's a pretty impossible job because there's been a lot of art in the world.
I know. I looked at that and I went, whoa. So how are you doing that?
How are we doing that? Meaning, are we being successful or?
Well, I know you're bringing a lot of art through Art Authority, your website, and the work that you do. And later we will get into how you do your printmaking and that. So is your website your main vehicle?
Well, we have really three parts to the company. One is the website, which is our retail. Mm-hmm. And then we have a lot of work we do with individual museums all over the world. Mm. And so we do a lot of printing for their museum stores.
Wow.
And then I have my own little part, which is the fine art custom printmaking, where I work with individual artists and photographers.
And it's printmaking. So you're using a printer, not your average printer that, you know, you have in your office. I know they're extremely...
Well, they're very similar. Very similar. I mean, in many cases, we do have some of the smaller printers that we use.
I love that you are an imagician.
Yeah, that was a name that was given to me by Graham Nash about, 20 years ago.
And it still holds.
There you go.
So Graham Nash, well, that's really where you began you doing your photography printing.
That's correct.
Right, not your photography.
Right.
So what brought you to your love of photography?
I was 9 years old and went off to summer camp. And one of the activities that they offered was photography. Hmm. And I absolutely fell in love with it. After summer camp was over, I went back home and with my best friend who lived across the street, Richard, we started a company called Rimac Photo. This was like 10 years old, yeah. And we developed black and white film for all of the people in the neighborhood. And it lasted about 6 months. We had a great business card. But then I talked my third grade teacher into turning an old abandoned storage room into a darkroom. So we started doing, in third grade, started doing a lot of printing and photography. So,
wow, that's very enterprising.
Yeah.
So you, in third grade, started this, and then I'm going to imagine that you continued to do this through your school years?
I did. I all the way through college.
Mm-hmm.
And after college, I moved to New Mexico to a commune for a short period of time and decided that I wanted to take my life into New Mexico and into the commune, and was on my way back to Santa Cruz, California, where I was born and raised, and got picked up by the production manager from one of the production managers from Woodstock. And we took a three-day trip back to California, and he took me to a little town called Pescadero, which was about 20 miles outside of Santa Cruz. So, mm-hmm. And offered me a job the following weekend at the Big Sur Folk Festival, which was the second year they'd done that. And that was taking place at the Monterey Fairgrounds in Monterey.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I went and did that, and I dug ditches and pulled cables and ran spotlights and transferred musicians back and forth between their hotel and the venue. Mm-hmm. So it was quite an introduction to rock and roll.
Really ground up.
Yep.
Were you just thrilled to be doing what you were doing?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons that I left Santa Cruz in the first place to go to the commune was that the house I was living in, there was a band that lived there too, and they hated Crosby, Stills, and Nash because they said they weren't revolutionary enough. And I loved them. And so that we got into kind of a big argument. That was really an important part of me leaving.
Oh, wow. This was before you even had the job with them.
That's correct.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that something? Yeah. Sounds almost, fate. You put it out there how much you love them, and next thing you know, you have a job with the band.
Yep.
Oh, that's exciting. And so this other band that was in your house, they apparently didn't make it,
No,
did
they didn't make it.
Wonder how many Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's concerts they went to.
Yeah, exactly. Not as many as me, that's for sure.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you were with them a long time.
20 years. I did them. I did Carole King.
Yes.
I did the Tapestry tour with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a group called America.
Yes.
I actually was part of the management team for America. And then Peter, Paul, and Mary, I did them. And Poco. I don't know if you know the group Poco.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did you do some work with James Taylor?
No, nothing with James Taylor. Jane Fonda.
Oh.
I took Jane Fonda around the world with a group of about 80 people doing an anti-war tour in 1970.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, that had to be really something.
It was amazing. Yeah.
And she's still protesting.
That's for sure.
I love it. I haven't seen her picture in a while, but there was a few months ago where, she was getting arrested every Friday.
Yeah, exactly.
It was great.
Yeah, my first job in the music industry was an assistant truck driver. And all I did was kind of sit in the seat next to him. And a couple of times I had to take over. I'd never driven anything bigger than a Volkswagen. Mm-hmm. And my first driving of the vehicle was in the middle of Wyoming at about 1:30 in the morning. He pulled over and said, "It's your turn." He got me shifted into like 14th gear, and he went to sleep and said, "If you have any problems, just pull her over."
Over.
So I did that tour and came back to Santa Cruz, and I got a call from their tour manager. Crosby, Stills, Nash, his tour manager, saying, "Listen, I'm taking David and Graham over to England to do the old Grey Whistle Test," which was a very popular show in England. And I've just been offered the job to take Jane Fonda around the world. And I can't go because I'll be in England with them. So would you like to do it? And I said, "I've never done anything like this." He says, "You can do it." I started out with 35 singers and musicians. Donald Sutherland was my roommate the whole tour. And went out and did it and learned on the road.
Wow.
How to do it.
And were you at that time, I mean, you're traveling all over the world. You had to be taking photographs everywhere.
No, and I didn't. And I'll tell you the reason why. I didn't take any pictures. Well, very few. In the very end of my career, I started to take more because there were more people that were able to take over certain aspects of my job.
Oh, you were so busy doing your job.
Well, I had to carry with me a computer because I had to do all the accounting for the band.
Oh, wow.
You know, and that was just having a camera with me is the last thing I wanted to do at that point. Because it was something I'm sure was going to get stolen or left behind or whatever. So,
how was that for you?
Well, you know, I was so wrapped up in what I was doing that I really didn't have time to really even think about it.
Right.
You know?
Right. It was just something that got put aside for a while.
Well, when I went to, when we weren't on the road, we were in the darkroom. Nash had an amazing darkroom up in San Francisco. Had, you know, color, one side of it was for color, one side was for black and white, and temperature controlled filtered water coming out of the wall, and all sorts of mounting, you know, devices. And I mean, it was an amazing,
oh my scene, God. Yeah. I can't even imagine. I think of my younger brother had a dark room down in our basement that he rigged up.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought that was really something, but
no, this has had every
rudimentary doesn't even describe it.
Oh, yeah. Well, we would go in at, 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And then it was our housekeeper saying, time to go to bed. It was 8 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, how wonderful. Yeah. So it was really your soul's calling from when you were a young boy.
And then on the road, one of the things that we did was instead of staying up all night long, Nash and I would go to bed early. And get up the next day and go to all the bookstores and, you know, rare bookstores and art galleries and all of that. So we really kind of, I got a really great education in, you know, in those days.
And I think how amazing as well that Graham Nash had the similar love for photography that you did and art that you were pulled together. I mean, what a story. Not a lot of people in the world get to have those sorts of synchronicities and that where things just, their soul's calling just guides them and leads them and brings them together.
We kind of bonded the very first time I met him. This was the very first tour. I'd gotten picked up by the truck driver and I was going to be the assistant truck driver. And we drove to San Francisco and went to Nash's house to pick up his guitars. And it was about 8 o'clock at night and we pulled up. And we went in and up to the front door, knocked on it. Graham came to the front door. And the truck driver who had worked with him before said, Graham, this is my friend Mac. Graham said, come on with me. Took me into the room. He was, Joni, this is my friend Mac. Arthur Garfunkel, this is my friend Mac. I mean, it was amazing.
My God, I would have passed out.
Yeah. So it was, we really bonded with one another from the very beginning.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah.
What a story. So, wow. So then you started, how did it come about? Because you created Nash Editions later, well, many years later.
Many years later, yeah.
And had the world's first digital printmaking studio solely on photography. Yep. And where did you get the idea?
Well, what happened was I was responsible for the tour at one. I became tour manager eventually. And one of my jobs was to put together the itinerary, which was like a small little phone book with every day that, you know, all the telephone numbers and addresses and everything, which every member of the band and crew used to navigate the world. So instead of making them boring, I wanted to make them a little bit more interesting. So I started to make funny covers, you know, like the Three Stooges, Manny Moe and Jack, Boy Scouts, those types of things. And to do that, I had gotten a early Macintosh computer and a early scanner, which this scanner was so early. It was a style writer printer, which used a ribbon cartridge.
Oh,
and so you took the ribbon cartridge
I
out
remember.
And you put this one in and hooked it up the computer and you could roll into the printer, whatever it is you wanted to scan. Mm-hmm. And so I started to do this. Nash saw it and said, wow, that's really great. Do you think you could do like a photo in there?
Oh, mm-hmm.
So we put a photo in and scanned it, and it was kind of rough, but it was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me to put together a pretty high-end imaging and printing facility for him. And so I got him the state-of-the-art computer, state-of-the-art printer, and we started to put together some amazing images. And we found there was a company near UCLA that was making fine art prints on real paper. Prior to that, the only paper you could use was kind of a slick, shiny, glossy paper.
Right, like that's what they used for photographs at that time.
Absolutely. And we wanted to have something that had a more of a fine art feeling to it. So we started doing some prints there. And then one day Nash went in and they said, you know what? We're closing the doors. The company that makes the printer, which was Fuji in those days, they were discontinuing the printer. And so the guy that worked there said, but don't worry about it. There's a company in Bedford, Massachusetts that is making a really fantastic printer called the Iris 3047 printer.
Mm-hmm.
And so Nash bought one, $126,000.
Oh my gosh. And that was 30 years ago?
Yeah. And so we moved that into his pool house at his house in Encino. And it was there for a few months. And then his wife got very tired of people coming over to see the Iris printer.
So, how big was it?
It was about the size of two washing machines together.
Okay.
Yeah. So eventually he decided that he wanted to move it into another location. So he bought a house in Manhattan Beach, California, an old Sears kit house. It was the second oldest house in Manhattan Beach.
Oh, wow.
And it had a little carriage house in the back, and asked me if I would want to move to Manhattan Beach and manage the company. This was in 1991.
Now, let me think about that.
Yeah. So July 1991, I did my last show and moved to Santa Cruz, from Santa Cruz down to Manhattan Beach. And we started July the 1st, actually. 1991, we opened up the facility. And the first thing that we did was we took this $126,000 machine, which would only take very thin, shiny paper, and we hacksawed the heads off of it, violated the warranty so that it would take thicker paper. And so we started to print. And, you know, we created so much interest. And here we are with this small company with one machine, and we were getting way more press than some of the companies that had like 10 machines, you know, that were doing more commercial work.
Because you were using a different paper.
And we were using it for a different reason. We were trying to utilize the technology to create art and, you know, a higher end version of what these were. These machines were usually used for doing pre-press proofs for movie posters and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we really turned it around and started to use it for what we considered to be more legitimate means.
And how long were you in that initial phase?
Well, we one of the nice things was that Graham had given us enough money to actually do a lot of research for the first year or two. And we had a gentleman by the name of Jack Dugan, who unfortunately passed away a few months ago, a printmaker out from Santa Monica. And he was the one that came into the office one day and said, hey, you know what? I've been trying to get people interested in printing this with this method, but you know, the word digital is just, it just scares them away.
Mm.
And so I've come up with another term for the printing. And I said, well, what is it? He says, well, it's a French word called giclée. And what do you think? And I said, well, let's run it up the flagpole and see if anybody salutes. So a lot of people that were doing what we call the decorative arts really liked that idea. However, the museums, you know, and the kind of legitimate fine art venues were not so happy with it. From our perspective, meaning Nash and I, we had talked to a lot of our museum friends, and they just said, it doesn't say anything, you know.
Right.
if you said a digital pigment print, for instance, that mm-hmm. would have some sense of meaning.
Yes, yes.
So that's what most of the major museums took on, was a digital pigment print, because the inks eventually, in the early days, the inks were very fugitive. I remember one day I took a black and white print of Crosby that Graham had taken, and I was making a proof of it, and we went out to lunch, and we threw it on a table outside our and. My printmaker, Jack, threw a newspaper over half of it by accident. And we went out to lunch, and we had a very long lunch. We came back and pulled the paper off, and you could see where it had faded in that two to three hours that we were gone. Mm,
great mistake.
Yeah. But the prints were beautiful. You know, the inks went deep into the paper. And we worked with two or three different companies trying to develop more permanent inks. And eventually, by the time we got rid of the Iris printers, the inks had gotten up to about 50, 60 years in terms of their permanence. I was introduced in the year 2000 to Epson. This woman came in and said, "Hi, I'm with Epson. We're down the street. We'd like you to come in and look at our machines." So we took a couple of images down there, a black and white image and a color image. And they printed them both for us. And the color image was spectacular. And the black and white was really horrible. It was all green. So we knew we had some work to do. But at that point, color management was becoming an important feature of a digital printmaking. Mm. And I knew that with a little time and a little energy, we could develop a way of printing black and white that really was neutral. So started using the Epson machines. They gave us a bunch of beta machines to test out. And 2 years later, we rolled these $126,000 machines out to the curb.
I read that in 2005, that first Nash Edition Iris 3047 inkjet printer was incorporated into the photographic history collection of the Smithsonian's National Museum.
That's correct.
Of American history.
Yep.
That's not out to the curb.
Well, that one went there. That was our first machine. Yeah. What we had to do was the machine is a revolving drum, mm-hmm. and you actually taped the paper to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a lid that came down. And one of the problems was that it would generate a kind of a fine mist of this ink that was contained with the lid down. And so we had to do a couple of things, because what would happen is that fine mist would find a little piece of paper fiber and start to, turn it into a droplet of ink, and that would plop down and ruin this print.
Sure.
So we took the lid off, and I took my wife's vacuum cleaner, and with clear plastic tubing, I put it down right near the head. So any of that extraneous ink was being sucked off. And so, we ended up getting a way that worked, and we had no longer had problems with the ink flipping down onto the paper.
In essence, you created a new printer.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
I love innovation. When did Art Authority, and now, because you did Nash Editions for
18 years.
Yes. So now you're with Graham Nash almost 40 years.
Yeah, it's about that. I remember the very first thing I did with him was on his 30th birthday. We both dropped acid and went to the beach and stayed up until dawn. So that was kind of our first,
those are great
outing
days.
Together. Yeah,
those are great days. When you said you moved to Manhattan Beach, I'm from the East Coast, right. So I didn't have the Manhattan Beach West Coast experience at that time.
Right.
No, I didn't even get to go to Woodstock.
Well, I'm old as dirt, so.
No, you're not. But you're probably a few years older than I am.
Yes.
How old have you
72.
Been? Okay, so yeah. I'm 63.
Right.
But those couple of years, I missed. I was in 68, I was in Europe for the entire summer with my grandmother, but I was only 11 years old.
Well, I was living in San Francisco and Santa Cruz and.
Oh, yeah, I know. I wish I was there. Sometimes I think it was a blessing that I missed that, because who knows, there's just enough wild child in me that I might have gotten in a little too much trouble. So it was a good protection for
me.
Well,
I was always surrounded by great examples of what not to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was too. Isn't that great? It saved me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because I was the one rescuing everybody doing too much.
Yep.
And overdosing, doing everything. And I'd be the one jumping in and taking them to the emergency rooms or doing. So I knew that there was a limit I did not want to pass.
Right.
And ultimately, you know, just smoking pot was good enough for me. It was.
Well, I had traveled a lot before. I went to a private high school in Arizona, and we went and lived with Mexican families all over Mexico. And I worked on the Indian reservation. And then when I was in college, I was picked out to go to, as an exchange student, to an all-black college in Jackson, Mississippi, called Tougaloo. Mm-hmm. And so I did a semester there. My roommate was shot down by the police the fourth week I was there.
Oh, boy.
So, I mean, it was, I had seen a lot of life, which was good.
Yes.
And learn how to deal with it. You know?
Right. And a lot of cultural diversity.
Yep.
Which is so necessary. And I grew up in a city. I grew up in Newark, actually, New mm-hmm. Jersey. So I understand the cultural diversity, the necessity of it when we're young.
Absolutely.
It influences who we become mm-hmm. and who we don't become. We definitely need that.
Yeah, I grew up in Santa Cruz, which is about as white as you could get. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there was one black family in town.
Right. I did the same. When I grew up in Newark, but in third grade, my parents moved across the river mm-hmm. to a suburb. And it wasn't long before I realized there were no people of color mm-hmm. or any other culture than white. Mm-hmm. And I went home and I was yelling at my father. You knew that there was only white people in this town and you moved us here. I was so angry. And I said to him, the day I'm legal, right. I'm leaving here. I will not stay. And because it proved over and over again, people's ignorance. And my father's business was still in Newark. And I would beg, you know, after school, take me down the bakery, take me to Newark, get me out of this town after school, as long as I didn't have to be there.
Right.
So we'll get off of that because that's a great, but that is a great topic and it's a very timely topic.
Yep.
How do we get people to understand the richness of cultural diversity?
Well, by being exposed to it is one way.
Yes, because then it's hard to have those prejudices
yep.
when you recognize how same people are.
Mm-hmm.
That was something I loved growing up in Newark. It didn't matter who you were. What do you do at Christmas time? What do you eat? What kind of food do you have? Mm-hmm. Didn't even matter what holiday. What kind of foods do you eat? It was
called humanity.
Yeah, it was so rich.
Mm-hmm.
And try some of my grandmother's this, or mm-hmm. you know, kids would bring things to the playground, and wow. Mm-hmm. And then I was 11, and I got to go to Europe.
That's,
what do you do
that's
after
an
that?
Eye opener.
What do you do after that? I am so upset that we can't be in Europe. I thought I would be in Europe this summer.
Right.
Oh, I'm not happy.
Right.
Because America is a beautiful place, but mm-hmm. it's very young and it doesn't have the culture and it doesn't have the art.
It has the nature though, which
yes.
is nice.
Oh, we have beautiful. It's beautiful. Yeah. It's absolutely gorgeous.
I just came
gorgeous.
Down the Oregon coast last week and oh my God, it's gorgeous.
A few weeks ago, I said to Jasmine, let's get out of here.
Right.
Let's do the coast.
Right.
And we did. We drove up to Portland and across, and we were going to go up to the peninsula, but I said, let's not overdo it.
Right.
And we took our time coming down the coast. It is. It's different than the Jersey, the East Coast.
Yes.
We have the beach.
Yes.
It's the beach,
yes.
But the coast is so majestic.
Oh, yeah. I remember climbing on top of one of the dunes, on the Oregon dunes, and came over the top of it, and you could see beach as far as the eye could see with no people.
Right.
You know, it would not be the same in New Jersey.
No. No, not in the wintertime even.
Yeah.
It wouldn't.
Yeah.
I lived right on the beach.
Uh-huh.
And I would love when the summer was over and everybody go home. Had my whole beach to myself.
Yeah.
Oh, life is good.
Amen.
And I was very possessive, you know, get off my beach.
Right.
But you couldn't do that too often. I'm going to back up and get back on course. Who were some of your top clients when you were with Nash Editions?
I did a lot of work with David Hockney. He was always very interested in exploring, you know, kind of what was happening at the time, the new tools. Francesco Clemente, who was a New York artist. We worked with Pedro Mayer, who is a Mexican photographer. He was actually our first client. He's living in Mexico now, but he lived in the United States for the years that I was working with him. He had done a lot of stuff for Life and a lot of major magazines as a photographer.
So you would take his photographs,
yep,
and make digital prints.
That's correct. Douglas Kirkland, I don't know if you know that name.
I've heard the name.
Yeah, very famous for his work with Marilyn Monroe. He was I believe it was a Look magazine photographer. He was like 18, 19 years old. And they wanted to do a feature on Marilyn Monroe. And so they wanted to make it unique. So they hired this young shooter from, you know, I think Rochester, New York, or someplace like, maybe it was Buffalo, New York, and flew him out to Hollywood. And he did this whole shoot with Marilyn Monroe.
Wow, what a way to get on the map.
Absolutely.
You did the print?
He came, there was a gentleman from Apple Computer who brought him over to the studio one day, and we worked on some of his images. Some of the images that are still being printed today, he's actually using different technology now, but he's in his, I think he's in his 80s right now. And another great client we had was a man named Horace Bristol. Horace Bristol was one of what they call Steichen's Chickens, which was a group of photographers in the military that were assigned to different areas of the war. And Horace was in Japan and had done some amazing photographs. And when the war was over, he came back to Los Angeles, and he wanted to do a feature on the Dust Bowl refugees that were coming into the Central Valley in California.
Mm.
So he thought, wow, you know, I can do the photos, but I should find somebody to write the text. So he heard about this young writer up in Oakland, California, by the name of John Steinbeck.
Oh.
And he called him up and said, hey, listen, I'm doing this. Would you like to come along? He said, great. So the two of them spent about 6 or 8 weeks going up and down the valley, the Central Valley. And when they came back, Horace went back to L.A., Steinbeck went back to Oakland, and Horace got all of his images ready, picked the ones, edited the ones that he wanted to do, and then called up Steinbeck and said, I've got all the pictures ready. How is the text coming? And Steinbeck said, well, Horace, I got some bad news for you. He says, this story is way too important. I'm writing a novel. And that novel became The Grapes of Wrath.
Yes.
And so Horace was in his 80s when he came to work with me. We had gone up to his house and gone through his whole archive, and he'd seen some amazing pictures from Bali, which took him like 27 days to get there in those days, to Japan. He did a whole feature on the pearl divers. So we decided, hey, Horace, why don't we do a portfolio? We'll come in and go through your images, and we'll pick like a dozen of them and put together a nice little portfolio. So we did that. And we were working on a couple of the images that he did from the Grapes of Wrath images.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in my studio sitting next to me, and I'm working on one of his images. Now, you got to understand, as a magazine photographer in those days, he would take the pictures and send the film back.
Yes.
You know, to New York.
Right.
And some editor would, they develop
and there's no copy and no
everything.
Credit.
So he had no
input. Oh, what a
input.
Shame.
So anyway, so he's sitting next to me. I'm working on a picture of the Rose of Sharon,
mm-hmm,
with a baby at her breast. And I said, so Horace, what would you like to do with this? He says, well, you know, you see that guy's knee in the background there? It's real white. I always thought that was kind of distracting. So maybe you could take it down. So I went and took it down. And I says, anything else? Didn't hear anything. I said, I turned and I said, Horace, anything else? And he's sitting there, he's got a tear running down his cheek. I says, are you okay? He said, I'm okay. He says, I'm just so sad. All this wonderful technology has come so late in my life.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, it was like, ugh.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
So we ended up doing that for him. And I mean, this guy was amazing. He was in the hospital, in his hospital bed, sending me emails on the internet, you know, with images in them.
Oh, my God.
And he finally passed away years ago, but an amazing man.
He sounds, everything you're saying about him, the whole story, my body is electrified. I've got tears coming out of my eyes. I'm thinking, what a life. Yeah. How rich. Oh, yeah. I would love to see, I would love to see his photography.
Yeah, well, look him up.
Yes, I will.
He's got an amazing, group of fabulous photographs from all over the world.
So addicting.
Yeah, yeah.
It is very, I'm not a bad addiction to have.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And unless you run out of wall space in your home, that's another story, but. And are you still involved with Nash Editions?
No. Okay. I haven't been involved with Nash Editions since 2008.
Okay.
What had happened was Graham's son had decided that he was going to help his dad with all of his businesses. So in 2008, did you remember there was a little problem with the economy?
Just a small one.
Yeah. Well, he convinced his dad that I had driven the company into, no money. And it was my problem, which of course it wasn't. I mean, a lot of our number one clients all of a sudden weren't sending us work. Sure. Everybody was shutting down.
Things changed.
So I, I looked at it and I just said, best friend, son.
Right.
And I said, I got to get out of Dodge. Mm-hmm. So I packed up my family and we moved to, we had bought a house in Ashland 20 years before.
Mm-hmm.
And we had been renting it out. So we decided this was time for us to move to Ashland. Been here since 2008.
2008.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
That's wonderful.
So I started a company here called the Image Collective with a friend of mine from the Getty Museum. He was kind of working in the imaging area in the Getty. He was getting ready to get out of LA himself. So he finally came up about 5 years ago. And we ran that until our main supplier of images, which was a gentleman in the United Kingdom. We were representing about 20 different museums in the UK.
With the Image Collective.
With the Image Collective. And then it was about 2 weeks before Christmas. We get a call from him. He's gone bankrupt. And so everything was shut down. So at that point, we kind of decided, well, we got to find something else to do. And we had been kind of playing footsie with Alan Oppenheimer and Jim Tease here. And so this seemed like an obvious opportunity for us to create something viable. And we started Art Authority. Bought a company out of Seattle called 1,000 Museums. That's the kind of the retail arm of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And then Art Authority is kind of the museum part of our company.
And you work with the museums all over the world.
Yep. It's been tough for us, though. You got to imagine. We've survived, but survival is the new success these days.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Okay. Where is your studio that you do the printing for the museums?
It's over on Mistletoe.
Okay. So right here in Ashland.
Yeah.
Now you have a number of prints for a museum in somewhere in Europe, and you have to get them to them.
Right.
Is this part of your issue right now?
No. I mean, it's, it's always been an issue shipping internationally. I mean, we're sending over huge masses of prints over to Korea. We do Australia, England, some France a little bit. So
how has our times now, COVID, affected you?
Well, the museum's all closed.
They're closed.
There's half our business. They're coming back now. We just got an order for 2,500 prints from a major museum in LA.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So we have, yesterday was Panic Central because we had just lost one of our employees who moved back to Maine. And we have one of our employees who's leaving tomorrow to take her daughter back to college. And so we were very shorthanded. So it was all hands on deck. Anyway, so I was stuffing prints yesterday and we hired a temp today. So
you're still right there, hands on.
Oh, yeah, you have to be.
Yes. You have to see everything that goes out.
Yep.
Your name is on it.
Yep.
So you had quite a period of a lull here now.
Yeah, and it's starting to open up. I mean, it was in the New York Times last week that several of the museums in New York are reopening. Houston, which is one of our biggest clients, they're opening. So,
oh, that's great.
Things are starting to come back to life.
I'm curious how things will evolve.
It's going to be a different world.
It's interesting to see how we are going to just be.
And it's all in the middle of this political upheaval that's going on, you know?
That's really exciting, actually,
because
it's going to be really bad. It will continue to get bad and get worse, but it's just really clearing out all the old garbage.
Yeah.
And then we can rebuild in a way that I think will really honor who we are as a country.
I hope you're right.
That's I'm hopeful. Sure. I'm an optimist.
Yes.
I must remain optimistic.
You have to be.
These next few months, we're really on the edge of our seat to see what's going to happen. And it will take some time after that before it even begins to look good again.
Yep.
I just kind of follow the cosmos and see what's happening there, how it predicts what will happen down here. And, you know, as above, so below.
Yep.
So tell me your first story about your Apple computer that you used.
Well, when we first started, the Iris printer actually had a PC built into it. However, there was no monitor. So what you did, there was a LED window on the printer, and you could adjust the contrast and the volume of cyan, magenta, yellow, and black, and that was it. So proofing was a really important part. I mean, we did, you know, probably 10 to 15 proofs on everything because you couldn't see what you were doing, really. You just had to try something, and after an hour, it came off the printer, and it was, you know, too magenta, so you went in and you took
fine-tuned
the magenta. So anyway, so what we were really looking for a way to get beyond that, and that was to have our own computer that we could send to the Iris printer. And see the images on the screen. So we bought... Before it went to the printer. So we bought, I can't even remember the model number of what it was, but it was like the first high-powered Macintosh that came out. And we bought a 32-bit monitor, which was our first big monitor that actually gave us pretty accurate color. And we were... you know, still, it was pretty hard in those days before color management really came along to match the screen with the printer. But you could at least say, look at it and go, well, it needs a little bit more magenta. So you could kind of dial it in on the Macintosh and know that you had given it a sufficient amount of change.
Mm-hmm.
So it took us down to about doing about 5 or 6 proofs.
That had to be very expensive.
Oh, it was. I mean, we, you know, the paper itself, we were using some of the Arches fine art papers that were, you know, $16 to $20 a sheet.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So when a print came out and it was not correct, it was an expensive thing. I think in those days, we were charging about $750 for a large print. Things have changed a lot.
Now, what do you charge for a large print?
Oh, you know, probably $60-$70.
Sure. Things have gotten so
and
different.
If I get, you know, I mean, if like this morning I was working on a print up, a client had a special request for doing it life size, meaning whatever the artist, you know, originally did. And it was quite large, quite a bit larger than the largest prints that we offer. So I had to up-res that image to make it big enough to print that large.
Wow.
And that was probably more than $60 or $70.
I would imagine as much.
Yeah.
You know. Interesting. So you're still challenged by some things.
Oh, yeah.
Still have a few things.
But, you know, color management is really, I mean, I don't do more than usually one proof now. Because you're able to accurately gauge how an image is going to look on the screen.
Right.
So.
And I'm sure you're just so simpatico with your equipment.
Oh, yeah. By this time, I better be.
So I understand when you were tour managing, you used an Apple computer and created a spreadsheet for the tours that you were doing.
I remember one day I was working in a management office in Hollywood and doing all the tour planning. And the problem with doing it in those days was you did it on paper. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I've got, we'll say, six musicians, and I've got a crew of 12, and I've got to, put together a spreadsheet by hand. So you get it all done, and then Crosby calls up and says he's taking an extra musician. So I had to go in with the eraser and the whiteout and everything and redo it. This friend of mine who was a tour manager for another group came by one day to visit and said, hey, listen, I got to show you something. I've got a computer in the car, and they've got this automated spreadsheet. So we went out to his car and hauled it in, set it up in my office, and it was like, oh, my God. It really changed everything.
Oh, I bet.
You know, because when you add an extra person in, that means you got to add in extra per diem. You got to add in extra hotel, add in extra flights.
Sure, right down the line.
And here I've got, we'll say 12 employees. Well, I want to make it 13. Well, that automatically updates everything.
Right down the
line. So it changed my life on that level.
Gave you a lot more time.
Yeah.
And then
I did things like guest list was always a big deal. You know, the kunga player would come up and say, I got two guests around. So I'd take out a piece of paper and write it down. And then the drummer would come up. And then Crosby would have 15. You know, so keeping track of all the expected guests for a show was pretty complicated. So I built a little DBase program for it so that it just automatically, input all of the information, and then an hour before the show or 2 hours before the show, I'd print it out and it would automatically create a guest list. I'd take that to the box office.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. Oh, I just sigh of relief.
Oh, yeah.
And you know that it was all there because I know the story, pieces of paper here and pieces of paper there, and you have to put it all together.
Yeah, it's like, oh, crap. You reach in your back pocket and there's that's Crosby's. Oh my God, I better get out to the box office quickly.
I call it the cut and paste days.
Yes. Yes.
When you had to cut and paste everything. Oh my God.
Yeah. The computer really changed, and then I can, which I did not get to see is the revolution that the iPhone created on the road. I mean that, it's like these guys have got it made now. I remember in the early days when we had to go from city to city, I needed instructions for the truck drivers, okay? Mm-hmm. And there was a feature with Beacon van lines that you could go to this site and you could type in two names of cities and it would give you the distance and the routing.
Great.
But it was like $300 a month.
Oh, my.
But that's what we had to use because there was, no internet in those days.
Right.
So it's got to be a piece of cake these days.
Oh, pop it on your phone.
I mean, you can imagine flying into Cincinnati at 7 o'clock at night mm-hmm. with, the band and the crew and getting like seven rental cars and then trying to figure out how to get to the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was crazy.
Now it's just so nothing.
Oh, yes.
No matter where you are in the world.
Yep, it's true.
Which is great.
Yep.
I still love a map.
Yeah.
I still love to pull out a map and look at, because you don't get that same feeling. But I was in Europe in 2006, between 06 and 07, on just a walkabout. I was there for about 6 months, and I did not take a cell phone.
Aha. There you go.
And it was very interesting. It was, I couldn't believe it, but I actually liked not having the phone, mm-hmm. but it was so different. And then now I've been back to Europe, I don't know how many times since then with my phone. It's just incredible. No matter where you are, it doesn't matter. You just pop it into the phone and if you don't speak the language, pop it in.
Yep.
It's incredible.
Yep.
And it's no bigger than your palm of your hand, which is when you travel, I like to travel light. Mm-hmm. I just can't. I remember even carrying digital when I was in Europe in 06. I had my, and it was just a small digital camera, but still it's more weight. It's more something to carry. I'm sure you use state-of-the-art camera.
Well, I have a couple of state-of-the-art cameras, mm-hmm. but I do use my cell phone a lot.
And you get quality pictures?
There's software out there today that uses artificial intelligence to make images larger mm-hmm. that works like a charm.
You can take something from your phone and enlarge it to look like you were using a super duper camera.
Yeah, you're probably not going to get it exactly the same level of sharpness and all of that, mm-hmm. but it's pretty amazing.
Mm, yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I know the phone has become, it's become such an easy thing to use as a camera, but at the same time, I mean, for most people, it doesn't matter. It's fine.
Yeah, snapshots.
Right. It's fine. But for anyone who's looking for anything of any quality, that's
well, I've always
story.
Been a proponent of the fact that I'd much rather have an interesting image than a super sharp image.
Right.
I mean, if I was taking shots with my old Brownie, I have a collection of cameras.
I bet you
400
do.
Old cameras.
Really?
Yeah. And so, but if I was taking a picture with my box camera and I got a very interesting photograph and it wasn't super sharp, that to me would be more important than having this, you know, a really sharp image of an uninteresting image.
I want to sidetrack. I want to go back to Art Authority, because I noticed last night that you're featuring 2020 as the year of the woman.
Yes.
Tell me about that. It was exciting when I saw that and I popped up some of the art, but it was late. I couldn't stay on much longer.
Well, you know, you were asking about how we add new images and things to our site. And, you know, one of the things that's very, very obvious and has been for years is that women are underappreciated in the world of fine art.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of all came together with me and Alan and some of the people that work with us, that being able to focus on and bring to the public a lot of female art, women's art,
mm-hmm.
that has been overlooked and underappreciated. I went back to the National Geographic, maybe 6 months ago. One day I had an off day and I went to the Women's Museum, the National Women's Museum of Art. And it was amazing. You know, I had not realized the extent of underappreciated women art. So I spent an entire afternoon there. This place has got like, I think, three or four floors.
Where is it?
It's the old Masonic Temple. Okay. That the foundation bought, I believe, in the late 80s or early 80s,
mm-hmm.
and put millions of dollars into it. And it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous place.
Oh, I want to go.
It's all marble staircases and just spectacular.
Marble is art all in itself.
Oh, yeah. No, it's really well worth. I can't remember the exact what streets it was on,
mm-hmm.
but I walked from the National Geographic over there. So
I definitely have to go. I definitely have to see that. And it's great right now. Your timing is perfect. It's women are finally coming into a place of recognition on all levels. How many women we have, more women we have in Congress now and in the Senate, representing our country and the world. And art is such an intricate part of that.
Oh, yeah.
On every level of our being.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that we will be able to reserve and maintain art through our educational system.
Mm-hmm.
There will be a different take on that.
Well, why spend it on art when you can spend it on sports? Come on.
Don't get me started. Do not get me started.
I just last week went up to near Salem. I have a friend who's from New Jersey who is a documentary filmmaker. And she has created a movie called Like a Woman. And it is interviews with women all over the United States who have taken traditional male jobs. Helicopter pilots, mm-hmm. blimp pilots, motorcycle racers, mechanics, and it's a really fascinating movie. And she has come across the United States showing it to very small groups of people, like maybe 15, 20 people.
Really?
Yeah. And always outside. She's got a big portable screen and a digital projector. The one that I saw up near Salem was that there was a bunch of young teenage girls there. And what was really fascinating to see was how inspired they were by what they saw.
Absolutely.
You don't see the woman mechanic who lives in Detroit. And
that's
you don't
right.
see the blimp pilot that lives in Carlsbad, you know? Mm-hmm. And to have it all there to show that, hey, this is really happening. Women are really doing this.
That's right.
It's fabulous.
That's right. It is fabulous. Yeah. I was having a discussion with someone the other day about during the war when the women took over in the factories
yeah.
because the men went
Rosie.
To war. And then the war ended, and then we saw pictures of women in high heels and aprons in kitchens.
The 1950s.
And what propaganda was that?
Three steps forward and five backwards.
Oh, dear. That was just on, you know. Well, we're getting there. We have more steps forward now. This sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
Oh, someone I would actually like to interview as well. I'm like, that would be fab. That would be great for my radio station.
Well, I can put you in touch with her for sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. She's on her way back now. She's going to be... I think back in about a week into New Jersey.
She would absolutely be someone I would
yeah.
love to interview. I'm backtracking again.
Okay, that's fine.
There's no way to be all chronological with you.
That's fine.
There's so much going on all over the place. So what were your favorite concerts while you were managing the tours?
Well, I think that, in 74, we did Wembley Stadium. And you know, we did close to 500,000 people. I mean, it was just huge. Probably the favorite U.S. venue is Pittsburgh, believe it or not. For whatever reason, they just always went crazy for us in Pittsburgh. Are you aware of the Three Rivers Stadium?
I've heard of
it. It's gone now. It's mm-hmm. torn down, mm-hmm. but it had a roof that opened up. In those days, you could smoke cigarettes and pot and whatever you
everything,
wanted.
Everything,
okay?
Right.
So that created actually an atmosphere in the venue. When they quit that and made it illegal, we actually had to bring in smoke machines mm-hmm. because without the smoke, the spotlights don't look like anything.
Mm.
So anyway, what we do is we play the show in Pittsburgh. People would go nuts. They do Teach Your Children for the encore.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody is singing. And it's all smoking like that. And then we had to pay $2,500 to open up the roof.
Wow.
So we'd open up that roof and all the smoke and everything would go up and the fresh air would rush in. I mean, it was just like amazing.
Oh, my God. That's really exciting.
Yeah. And we were pretty well loved just everywhere we went. I mean, they really had a great following. They still do.
I was just going to say, and still. I have their music on my radio station.
Yep.
I play it all the time.
Yep.
And how it's timeless. There's never not be Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
Yeah.
And who else? Who were some of your favorite personalities, your favorite musicians? And
I always got I had a good feeling with Art Garfunkel. He would come to our shows and we'd end up back in the dressing room, during the show, even mm-hmm. talking and swapping stories.
Mm-hmm.
James Taylor was always a really, really nice man, mm-hmm. really humble man to mm-hmm. me.
Yeah, I would imagine he seems like he
yeah.
is.
Well, those are probably the two most memorable people that I mm-hmm. had any sort of relationship with. So,
and you said you got to meet the Beatles.
Well, I didn't meet all the Beatles. I met a couple of the Beatles.
Who did you meet?
I met Ringo,
mm-hmm.
and I met George Harrison. So,
you ran across some. I mean, Jane Fonda.
Well, I also was in the Troubadour, which was the place in L.A. the night that John Lennon got thrown out. And I was in the bar. I wasn't in the show, in the actual showroom. And they grabbed him and threw him out and went right by my table with him, with two guys, and threw him out the door.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. People ask me when I'm going to write my book, and I say, I have to wait for a few more people to die before I can really write my book.
Before you can tell all.
Yeah.
I am just wowed through... What a great life. And you guys, I know you toured all over the United States, but where else? Obviously in England. And
Japan.
Mm-hmm.
We did Australia. We did mm-hmm. Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We never did anything in South America or Mexico, which was, I never quite understood why. I guess there just wasn't, any sort of interest there.
And through Europe?
We went to Germany, France, all over Europe. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, when you were on tour and you were in all these different foreign countries, were you able to appreciate being there at all? Or
it all depends. I remember once we were in, we were in Italy, and then we went to we were in Spain, and we were supposed to go to Italy, and there was some problem with the promoter, and so we had to cancel the show. So we went to a little town on the coast of Italy and spent like 3 days in this really amazing little hotel right on the cliffs.
In northern Italy?
No, right out, it was called off this island, Cerce.
So you were on the eastern coast.
That's correct.
Oh, it's very different than the western coast.
It is.
Just like the
United
States.
But it was beautiful.
Oh, it's beautiful everywhere.
I felt like I was in a Hercule Poirot movie,
And the food.
Yeah. Oh, God, every night we had these amazing three-hour meals that, underneath the grapes.
Isn't it fabulous?
Oh, yeah, it was fabulous.
You just start about 8, 9 o'clock.
Yep.
And so many courses and bottles of wine later.
Oh, yeah.
I love that lifestyle. That's...
Yeah, it's a little more laid back than it is here, that's for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And to me, that is the lifestyle. I mean, I love that lifestyle. Uh-huh. That is, for me, what life is about.
Yep.
Because, and not being able to have that now. It's been very challenging.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm like, come on, I got food on the table. Come on, sit down and eat. And I grew up in that culture.
Yeah.
And when I was in Europe, when I was 11, and we were visiting my cousins in southern Italy, it was one of their birthdays. We had an 11-course meal.
Oh, yeah.
And a birthday cake that my cousin made because they had a bakery. About as big as this table. I'm like, I kid you not, with like a bottle of rum in it.
Yeah.
and everything else. I had never seen anything like that. So I can imagine all the countries you were in, the different... That's why I was curious if you were like just in lockdown doing the concerts.
I remember we had when we were in Japan once, there's a world-famous toy museum in Yokohama, which is just above Tokyo. And we went up to the toy museum, and it turns out that the guy that owned it was a huge Hollies fan, which was Graham's first band.
Wow.
So he said, here, I'll take you on a tour. So we were walking along. We came into this one room, which was all toy robots.
Oh, boy.
And there was one really amazing robot. And I looked at it and said to Graham, boy, that's a great robot. So the guy calls over one of his assistants, whispers in his ear. The next room we go into, this assistant comes back and he's got two boxes of the same robot, one for me and one for Nash.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we go into the next room, and there's this giant St. Bernard. And Nash whispers to me, don't say anything about the dog.
When did you start to record? Record, because, everybody was recording even in the 60s, the early 60s, the late 50s. How did you guys record live? That must have been really something to be setting that all up.
Yeah, well, there was always a crew that did that,
you know?
So we didn't record, very often because, it added a whole nother flavor to the show, knowing that it was being recorded
mm-hmm.
on the part of the musicians and all of that. So, mm-hmm. But we did, we did a lot of specials and stuff, TV specials,
mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
So.
And did a lot of studio recording.
A lot of studio recording, yeah.
All that out of L.A.?
Mostly out of Los Angeles, yeah. We would when we were living in San Francisco, we'd fly down to the to LA and record and stay at the Chateau Marmont. The only problem with that for me was they had a tendency to do their rehearsals at the recording studio at $150 an hour. So it would be like a week or two before they got to the point where they decided to actually start recording. We recorded in Miami several times. San Francisco, the record plant up there, we recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Wally Hyder's up in San Francisco. That was actually the first recording studio I was in, was Wally Hyder's in San Francisco. Mm. Yeah. And then we started our own studio. Graham had in San Francisco in his basement, he had an amazing recording studio. And his wife, once he got married, decided she didn't like to have it down there. So we took all the equipment and we moved it to LA to, are you familiar with Crossroads of the World there?
No.
Okay. It's a whole complex that was built in like the 30s, 40s. It's got this giant tower with a big revolving earth on the top of it. And there was an old building there that was unused, and we ended up leasing the building and built an amazing studio there called Rudy Records. Hmm. And we recorded the Eagles and a lot of different people we recorded mm-hmm. there. So mm-hmm. we did that for probably 7 or 8 years and then lost interest in it.
You had bigger and better things coming up.
Absolutely. So, but that was a fun time.
It sounds really just amazing. Nonstop, intense all the time.
Yeah. The management office was at Crossroads.
Mm-hmm.
And the main structure at that's on Sunset Boulevard, there's an office upstairs, and then the tower comes off of that. Mm-hmm. And that office was our graphic designer's office, mm-hmm. whose name was Phil Hartman.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Really?
Yeah, John Hartman was his brother who actually ran the management office. And Phil was he was the guy that did the Crosby, Stills, and Nash logo, you know, the three
really?
Letters together. He did the Poco cover of the horse with the red eye. He was doing the Groundling Theater in those days, so mm-hmm. I got invited several times to go. He was working with Pee Wee Herman, and he would always, he just
Pee-wee.
Kept, you know, at the end of the day, we would always go into John's, his brother's office, and have a beer or whatever, and Phil would just crack us up. He just had us in tears.
He had to do nothing. Yeah. He just was incredible.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. What? Let me see what my notes. I have not even looked at my notes.
Here they come.
What do you see as today's trends in photography and printing?
Well, you know, it was funny. I went up to Epson hired me to go up to Bend last year to the Kando, C-A-N-D-O, K-A-N-D-O.
Okay.
Which is an event that is sponsored by Sony. I was going to be doing a presentation on workflow. How you work on an image. My friend Julianne Kost, do you know who she is?
No, I don't.
She's an evangelist for Adobe, and her specialty is Lightroom.
Hmm.
So she was up there too, and she's like world famous. We went to her presentation, and three people showed up.
Wow.
And I went, and I had two people at my presentation. And the point is that I think that a lot of, you know, with the advent of the iPhone and Instagram and filters and all of that,
I
think a lot of the millennials are kind of like happy enough with what they can do with those filters.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
My first thought was they didn't promote that.
Yeah.
But it isn't that at all.
Yeah. Brings up another question for me was, if you're not interested in learning how to optimize an image and you're happy with what you get on these in your iPhone, why are all these people so interested in higher megapixel cameras?
Right.
You know, it doesn't make sense, but that's the way it is. So I think I think there's going to be a lot less printing, number one. People are happy with seeing it on the screen.
Mm.
I don't think printing is going to go away.
Right.
But I think that there's going to be a lot less people interested in it.
That's interesting. I don't like the screen myself. It's there. I'm also a book person. Mm-hmm. I want to pick up a book and hold a book and read a book. This, I don't know what it is. I'm not crazy about it. I'm on it enough.
Mm-hmm.
But to look at art, I don't think that's the best way for me.
Well, it's not for me either, obviously. And I think that, you know, it's such a part of being a human, you know, being able to have that tangible feel of a print, you know.
Yeah, it's so interesting. It is, though, the iPhone generation, the millennials and who came after them. It really intrigues me because also all the AI, you know, the artificial intelligence and how they operate within that whole realm. Not having the influence or it's not, I shouldn't say the influence, but not having the connection to different texture, color, because you don't get that range of color from a screen, a telephone screen or a laptop or even a desk. You don't get that. And to not have that feels like deprivation.
Well, there's always a reaction against new technology, new tools. you know, I remember, you know, I, when I started out, I remember I got invited by Photo LA, which is a big photo event in Los Angeles. In the early 90s, they invited me to come in and show some of my prints. And I was in there one night about 7 o'clock, and this old photographer with a battered old Leica camera around his neck walks in, and he starts looking at the prints. And he look, and I walk over and I said, "So what do you think?" He says, "God, these are some of the most beautiful prints I've ever seen." He says, "How did you do them?" I said, "Well, it's a digital." The second I said the digital. Word digital, he completely stopped talking to me. He kind of took a step back and he spit on me. And
oh,
said,
my gosh.
And he said, "You're destroying photography."
Oh, my gosh.
So it's obviously, thank God, it's changed a lot since then. But that was kind of the attitude in those days.
Isn't it amazing how we are when it comes to change?
I you know, it's like what happened when somebody invented crayons? I mean, did or you know, when people invented watercolor? Did you know, the people that did oil painting get crazy? No,
or acrylics, for God's sakes.
Yeah, whatever.
Right.
And I don't care how you get the image. It's all about the image to me. You know, and there's this sense that, because it took you 4 weeks to make the painting, that it has a certain value.
Right.
I mean, if I can make a great photograph that moves people and touches people in an hour, what, you know?
Exactly.
It's still a great image.
Right. And it is the emotional impact.
Yeah.
And the feeling, that's the crux of all of it that we get from it. Mm-hmm. And you know, backing up just what I was just saying about the millennials and that generation, where does the depth of the feeling come from a computer screen? Mm-hmm. And there's texture and color, the richness.
Well, that's what's nice about printing on paper.
Right.
You know, there are so many substrates available to print on these days. I mean, you know, in the old days in the darkroom, you know, you had a wide variety of papers, but nothing like what you have today. Mm. We can print on washi papers from Japan. Mm. You know, we can print on cloth. We can print on metal. We can print on wood.
See, I see everything as art. Mm-hmm. Everything is art. And to square off a piece of that and create the image that you want to bring an emotional response, mm-hmm. that is an art.
It's one of the things that truly separates us from the animal world, you know, and makes us human, is our ability to even think about something as being art, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
I understand you studied sculpture.
Yes, metal sculpture.
And do you still do any of that?
You know, it's funny. Since I've been doing so much digital work, I've got the tools. Mm-hmm. I decided about 10 years ago I was going to get back into it. So I bought all the tools again. And they're still sitting on the shelf in my garage, mm-hmm. you know. Two things that I'm working on. One of them is rustograms.
Rustograms.
Okay, imagine taking a piece of polished steel, or iron actually is even better.
Okay.
And coating it with like a thin, clear varnish.
Okay.
Then taking a laser etcher and sending the information for a photograph onto it. And so you etch through the lacquer, right? Then you take that and you sit it outside and let it sit there for about a month. And so it's going to rust at different levels where, you know, depending on how much of the lacquer has been removed.
Now, where did you get this idea?
I've had this idea for probably 20 years.
Have you tried it out?
We've started to. I've got a doctor that I work with every Sunday in LA, and he funded me to get it up to a certain point. I was working with some guy in Medford who had a laser cutter, and the guy just didn't know what he was doing. Other things got in the way at that point. So that's one thing I'm working on. The other thing I'm thinking about is, I've got all these, you know, plastic in our lives. You know, I'm a big proponent of you know, plastics. Mm-hmm. I'm on the board, a board of the Agalita Foundation, which is Captain Charles Moore, who was the first guy that sailed out into the Pacific Gyre and saw the plastic mm-hmm. and kind of warned the world about it. I see all this plastic in my life, and I see, you know, blue plastic and white plastic and red plastic. And so I was thinking about starting to do my sculpture using these old plastic bottles and stuff and a heat gun. A heat gun, you can get temperatures over 1,000 degrees. Mm-hmm. And I could start to melt that and mold it and, you know, kind of create
like a sculpture
out of it, you know. And I could do that a lot easier than my metal sculpture, because metal sculpture, I need actually a concrete floor, and a room. And I just don't have the room at my house, you know.
And to laser into sounds pretty intense.
Yeah.
I like the plastic idea.
Yeah.
We're just so, God, overwhelmed with this.
Yeah, we're drowning in it.
There used to be a time you could boycott plastic. You can't even do that.
Did you hear that last? It was last week. There was a study. They said there's like something like 11 billion tons of microplastic in the Atlantic Ocean.
Oh, yeah, no. That's not new news. That's just, I didn't know how 11 billion tons, but
I know there's just,
there's microplastics in the ocean that people aren't even aware how they're affecting our well-being.
Oh, yeah.
And like I said, I remember, I can go back 30 years ago when we could boycott plastic and it was easy. You could really, and it wasn't that much of an effort to buy things that weren't in plastic.
Right.
You cannot do that anymore.
I remember going to Oaxaca a few years ago. I did a workshop down there and going into the market. When I was in high school going to Oaxaca, everything was wrapped in newspaper,
right?
You know, and they use like leaves and stuff over the, you know, instead of that blue plastic,
right?
A sheeting, that blue plastic is everywhere, and everything gets wrapped in plastic.
It's unreal. Yeah. It's really, you cannot get away from it. And I know in Bandon Beach, they've collected plastic.
Yeah,
and
there's
they've made a seabird and a seagull and a few other things. Which I thought was great.
Yeah.
And it also makes a statement about what's out there. I mean, it's so massive right now. I'm not optimistic.
You should check out the Agalita Foundation.
I will.
Yeah, Charles Moore, Captain Charles Moore. Mm-hmm. He told me a story about about Catalina Island, that there is so much microplastic in the waters off of LA that microplastics have a tendency to soak up toxic substances.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So they concentrate, and then the fish eat that, and then the bigger fish eat those fish. And the sea bass around Catalina, these substances act as artificial hormones. Okay. And so they cause sexual changes within the fish. Mm. So, you know, it's really, really scary what, the consequences of this could be.
When you said that the microplastics are absorbing toxins, that's great if we can get the microplastics then
out of the water.
Out of the water.
Yeah.
And not into the fish that we eat.
Yep.
I like to eat fish. I'm becoming really wary of eating fish.
Yeah, I am too.
I have a friend, a healer. She's my wizard. Where she has detected microplastics in my system.
Uh-huh.
She clears them because she's a wizard. But how about people that can't have that cleared from their system? Where do we go?
Yep.
What do we do with that? Yep. Well, microplastics are not going to affect artificial intelligence when we're living in a world of AI and there's no more humans left. Sad. But I thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
This has been a fascinating story. I can sit and listen to your stories for days on end. I just know that I can. Through this entire conversation, my body has been electrified with some of the stories you've told, and especially about some of the photographers and the artwork. And it's been very exciting. And now I can go back to your website for anyone who's interested, artauthority.net.
And 1000museums.com.
1000museums.com.
That's our retail site.
Well, I wish you well in these changing times. I'm happy the museums are opening up again for you.
Yeah, me too.
This has been just wonderful time. Thank you so much. This is Mary Alice, and I hope that you enjoyed that fascinating conversation with Mac Hulbert as much as I did. I loved hearing his stories of his pioneering times of being on the cutting edge of digital print technology and photography. And what great stories about his days in music, the people that he met, places that he traveled. I was so happy for him to have joined me today and take the time to have that conversation. So thanks for listening in. If you want to see more about Art Authority, you can go to artauthority.net or 1000museums.com. Thanks again for listening in. This is Mary Alice with love from my heart to yours.